Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. It is September 23rd. It's a Monday. Match day 34 is in the books. We are going to break it down for you. But first, it's Cup Final Week, Doyle. Wednesday, Campeones Cup, U.S. Open Cup Final, Canadian Championship with a CONCACAF Champions Cup spot on the line. Columbus, Club America, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. You can watch the pregame show at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time. It's on Apple TV, MLS Season Pass plus 2-day NA. Then at 10, Vancouver hosts Toronto at BC Place in the Canadian Championship Final. And finally, on Apple TV for free, LAFC in another final. Can they finally win one, hosting Sporting Kansas City, trying to make history? Should we like brand this Championship Week, Cup Week? Where are we going here?
I like the idea of branding it. I'm not a marketing expert though, so I'll leave that to someone else to come up with the right brand. But it's three cup finals in one night. It's pretty great.
I'm going to be in Charlotte, so I'm going to have to find a way to watch these. If you know a good soccer bar in Charlotte, please holler at me.
Why are you going to be in Charlotte? You and Sir Minty throwing back a couple shots?
Yeah, me and Sir Minty. Brown Liquor Special with Sir Minty. It should be really, really entertaining. It's going to be a one-sided conversation, unfortunately, but you'll get the vibes from Mr. Minty there. No, I'm going for some interviews. We're going to talk to Dean Smith, to Tim Ream, to Ashley Westwood, and a couple other folks for a feature.
Patrick Agyeman?
I am efforting an interview with Patrick Agyeman. The Hive is buzzing after that performance against New England. So I'm efforting that for Thursday's show, which I believe, it's not official. It's not like Give Me Sport Tom Bogert official, but I'm pretty sure Tom Bogert and you will be chopping it up on Thursday.
Okay. I didn't have that on my bingo card, but we'll see how that goes.
Okay, that might have been a lie. So whoever it is, it'll be wonderful. It'll be amazing. So enjoy that, but make sure you tune in on Wednesday night. Should be very, very fun. And I'm not kidding about that soccer bar wreck. I would love to hear from you Charlotte folks. Let me know. All right, let's start the same way we did last time, which is a little too long didn't read or too long didn't watch. I know it's not the second for all of you sickos listening to this show. On match day 34, two teams into the playoffs. That is the Rocky Mountain duo of Real Salt Lake and the Colorado Rapids. Sporting Kansas City, you're out. But you do have one more game this season that matters. That is, of course, that Open Cup final. In the Western Conference, the Timbers nearly killed Phil Neville. And Pablo Mastroeni has something to figure out. We'll dig into that in our match of the match day. Minnesota kept their lead on the playoff line at 5 points despite a big home win for FC Dallas. LAFC took that L. Now they got to figure things out. Galaxy. The front four ran absolutely rampant, Doyle. They all have 10 goals. That's the first time in MLS history we have four double-digit goal scorers on one team. The Caps took the L on the road, but again, they have a big final coming up this week. The Rapids rebounded, as they seem to always do from big losses, took that big-time L against Kansas City midweek, and then they made Toronto look like, well, Toronto, but they were looking forward to that championship final as well. Houston got a semi-bike winner from Coco in the Copa Tejas. Sorry, Austin, you are officially dead in my mind. And San Jose and St. Louis played a soccer game. Congrats to the Quakes on the wooden spoon. Jeremy Obobese had some interesting comments on that, which we'll get to at the end of the show. In the East, there is a sliver of hope in the Supporters Shield race. Miami dropped 2 points in the Bronx, and the Crew outscored and outlasted Orlando City, who I guess still haven't beaten anybody good. Nashville and Cincy played an entertaining and maybe controversial draw. We'll dig into that. The Red Bulls contrived to win, and then they contrived to lose, and then they ultimately drew, all thanks to Elias Manuel, and all is right in the world. Charlotte have been poor, and the antidote is the Revs. Just kidding. It's Patrick Agyeman. And also around the line, the Union beat the brakes off DC to jump the line, and Montreal are like Frankenstein. They mostly look dead, but they're alive. Doyle, what's the best thing you saw?
The NYCFC TIFO. I'm sure if you're on social media, you probably saw it going around because they unfurled a big banner. It was don't be plastic towards the visiting Inter Miami fans, and people, as they are wont to do on social media, kind of took it out of context. But like, I was a Metro Stars fan back in the day. I was in the stadium when Beckham and the Galaxy brought 67,000 people to Giants Stadium. And I know how disheartening it is to support a local team, to try to build a fan base and see a bunch of like fly-by-night fans just like helicopter in for the big show and cheer for the opposition and then never show up again. So I kind of know exactly where those NYCFC fans were coming from with that banner. And I understand why people didn't like the dumpy plastic part of it. But the more important one was in front of it. It said, support your local team. And that is true no matter where you are in North America. Support your MLS, USL, Canadian Premier League, all on down the list, man. Local soccer is the best. Seeing games live is the absolute best. That's the message behind that TIFO from the NYCFC fans. And, you know, tip of my hat and a heartfelt thank you to fan groups, hardcore fans, season ticket holders around the league who spend their time not just supporting their local team, but trying to build a culture in all of these games. It's what makes the league go. It's a big part of what makes it fun. So I felt that one deep in my heart when I saw that banner unfurl.
Did you play a solemn trumpet solo in honor of that? How did you?
What I'm was rusty. Your... I'm so rusty right now. I got to pick it up. Look,
I got to say, like when I saw the TIFO, I think I had a different reaction because I didn't have the same thought that you did about helicopter fans.
Yeah.
About the ones that show up for this game but not the other games. About the ones that you could find and flag down in the concourse and or whatever it is and say, hey, name one player on the blue. I think I was more taking it as a general swipe at the entirety of the Miami. I was like, hey, wait a second, like pot call kettle black, like come on, New York City. Like when you started, when you built your fan base, it was on the backs of big names. It was on the backs of David Villa and Frank Lampard and Andrea Pirlo, etc. So I think I came at it from maybe the wrong perspective.
I think it's understandable to come at it from that perspective, and certainly the takes that went nuclear on Twitter came at it from that perspective. But the more important one is the support your local aspect of it, because I guarantee you there are 20,000 Miami fans at least in the stadium for that one. It's not like 20,000 people came up from
now. Hold on, Miami South fans Florida. Or Messi fans,
and that's what the message that those are who the message was aimed at.
And look, that's fair enough too. You know, support your local club, like enjoy the game however you want to enjoy it. You know, if you're a Messi fan and that's who you are and you got a jersey from Miami because you love Messi and you want to show up to a game and spend your hard-earned money, I'm cool with that too. I also just think it's fascinating to have the supporters, the hardcore folks that are there for every game, look at you and say, don't think you're one of us. Don't think you're like us. And that's okay. That's culture, man. Everybody's going to approach it from a different perspective. I will say it is pure New York City culture for the Inter Miami bus to get a one finger salute in New York City. That means good luck. I love you. You're a person I support.
You're doing a great job standing on the sidewalk instead of walking.
Yeah,
None of us have to be at work. So you're doing great.
Keep not breaking up
Open
traffic
that
here.
Map.
Anyway, for that to happen under the train tracks there, right by Yankee Stadium, the BD4 comes right through there. That was iconic. That whole area is iconic in my opinion, just like by the stadium with all the bars, the dugout and, you know, stands and all those pre and post game spots that are absolutely legendary. And then you mix this soccer culture that's building in that area recently, as well as, you know, a century plus of sporting culture and Americana and the Yankees. That to me was one of those images where that is iconic. That is our soccer culture. All those middle fingers in the air to the Miami bus and Lionel Messi. Like, that's what's up, man. Like,
so, I mean, if you see Weeby in Charlotte this week, that's how you greet him, man. You give him that salute that Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez got from it'll make Weeby feel at home.
Exactly. If I see that, I'll know that you know me and you're thinking, hey, welcome to the Queen City, Andrew. We are happy to have you. All right. Like, I'll know that you're one of my people. Good stuff. Best thing I saw, Doyle, got to be the Galaxy attack. When they're at Dignity Health and all four are healthy and they're running downhill and there's space in behind and it just the momentum that they can build, from those deep lying areas of like boop, boop, one, two passes. Gabriel Peck is in space. Now all three of his teammates are just on their freaking horse to go join, because the general feeling is, one, there's going to be a big time goal scoring chance here. Two, we're probably going to score. Three, we've all got a celebration probably planned for afterwards, because two, we knew we were going to score. The first time four players hit double digits, absurd. I'm just going to straight up ask you, is Gabriel Peck the best winger in Major League Soccer?
That's a really good question. No, it's still Denny Bawanga. It's still Denny Bawanga, but it's a lot closer than I think anybody expected it to be 6 months ago.
I think it's Denny Bawanga on longer track record, bigger moments. But I think if you were just going on form right this second, who is better? I think it's Gabriel Peck.
Oh, form right this second. Yeah. But like LAFC have fallen off a cliff in the past 2 weeks. And we're going to talk a lot about what's coming on Wednesday. And that'll go a long way towards how we conceptualize Denny Bawanga and the type of year that he has had overall.
No, this is right where we should be. We jumped onto a new set of tracks. That's where I want to be. Well, the other names I'll throw into this conversation, it would have been Andres Gomez. Mm-hmm. He would have been right there, given his production and the way that he changed games in there. Facundo Torres has an argument right now. And then maybe the one that we're not thinking of, but that should be, because he kind of plays a tweener position between second forward, and winger. Jonathan Rodriguez. Been really good.
The same for Diego Rossi. I still think of Diego Rossi more as a winger than a playmaker or a forward. The truth is, in Wilfried Nancy's system, you kind of have to be all three at once. But like these are all guys who are super elite players, and Gabriel Peck, who is absolutely a true winger, deserves to be in that conversation.
All right, we're still in the third rail, and I'm keeping us there. Ricky Pooj is the entry pass god, and since you are an NBA nerd, I just was thinking about this. What is the NBA point guard equivalent of Ricky Pooj?
White chocolate. I'm throwing it back 25 years. He reminds me of Jason Williams, because Jason Williams was arguably the best passer in the league for years and years, and his teams won at a high level for years and years, but they didn't win the championship until he dialed some of that back and became a more responsible player. And Ricky is hopefully, I think, on that pathway. I think Greg Vanney has done a really good job over the past couple of games and sort of adjusting the structure, because once again, it was more like Marco Royce almost as like a true 10, Italian style Trey Quartista, where he's playing tight to the center forward and Ricky gets to run as a box to box eight. And it all orients itself to Ricky, where you can maximize that genius, you know, Messi level passing ability, and still sort of manage the turnovers that are just going to be part of that package at this point. I still think he needs to dial it back 10%. But in terms of just watching the guy, like greatest passers of all time in MLS, there's a three-person tier for me at the top. It's Messi, it's Carlos Valderrama, and it's Ricky Pooj.
You wouldn't, Echeverry wouldn't jump into that category.
No, I mean, like we're talking a half step down. Okay. For him, you know, and Landon was a different kind of passer.
Agreed.
Who was like, his gift was he hit a ball, like he could be full sprint, and his full sprint was like world class elite speed, and he would still hit the ball with perfect weight right into the stride. And there were not a lot of guys who could, like, that was not Valderrama's skill set, but just in terms of like pass it, like the number of passes that make you sit up and go, holy. Per 90, it's Messi, Valderrama, and Ricky Pooj.
I just think it's the vision too, to see gaps and to see openings that haven't opened yet, but will, but only for a split second, and to be able to technically, well, one, just recognize it, and then technically be able to execute it in all manner of different ways with all manner of passes of different types, whether it's a little chip ball, whether it's a swinging ball, whether it's, you know, kind of a spin cue ball that has the perfect, you know, little English to draw it right into the correct foot at the correct speed. That's why I think of a point guard with him, and why I think White Chocolate's a great shout, is because the variety of passes he's throwing are always designed to just sort of bounce up and hit your teammate in the hands in stride, or in soccer terms, you know, just find them in the exact perfect place where they don't have to think too much about what to do. It's already sort of plotted out for them. This is your action. This is the foot it's on. This is the pace that it's going. It's really fun to watch. Now, to your analogy here, what you want is for him to be Steve Nash in the playoffs, right? Where he can be equally dominant as a passer and a scorer, but he is extremely responsible in the way that he runs the offense and keeps things on track.
Yeah. Yeah. Though with, can we mix in someone who had a little more defensive stoutness than Steve Nash? Come on,
that ain't happening. Let's be real. That ain't happening. Yeah, it's Steve Nash or nothing. One more question, then we'll keep it moving here. Greg Vanney said this: the measure for our group is going to be the capacity to compete in the playoffs. That's the next step for us, is graduating from being a good in-season team to now taking that step to being a championship type of team. Are the Galaxy, given they have not lost a single match at Dignity Health, and it appears they will have home field advantage throughout the Western Conference playoffs, are they the obvious pick out of the West to make MLS Cup, and where would they rank in your list of cup contenders?
I still don't have them as the obvious pick coming out of the West. I know that LAFC are in a tailspin right now. They haven't been good the past 3 weeks. Olivier Giroud has not really hit the ground running at all. This is the conversation we had last week. They have so much equity with both of us in knockout round tournaments, not in finals, but in knockout round tournaments, which is what the playoffs are. And the Galaxy don't have that. The Galaxy have not done that with this group. They haven't done it with any group for a decade. And they have so many obvious flaws defensively. And we can give them credit for how they played in that second half against LAFC, but then they followed that up by getting their blows torn off. Well,
they're what?
Doors blown off. I don't know.
What was it? Their blows torn off?
I think we just had, like, we just have audio of me having a stroke. Yeah. They got killed by the Portland Timbers by making the same exact mistakes that they made in the first half against the LAFC. I might need to tap out after this one. That was bad.
That was really bad. That was good. It's like I heard it, and it just took me that beat and a half to be like, what? Hold on. What's going on here? I think I completely agree with you. I do think that they're not the obvious pick, but I think right now, form and location and just firepower considered, they are the pick just on paper. But they've had the talent all year long, and they just always seem to find that one moment in a game to be too open, make that 15-yard mistake positionally, or to just, to your point about Ricky, to just make a decision that doesn't need to be made in a moment that flips the field. So, yeah, playoffs are different, and you got to throw some shutouts. And shutouts are not this Galaxy team's, it's not their forte. Real quick, I just got to, this is my list. Best thing I heard, Torrey Pinto dropping the, however, I just love that the referees now announce video review conclusions, and they all have their own style, and I just love the however. And then, as a big children and life commitment out of wedlock guy, also a big Instagram reporter, congratulations to Sergio Busquets and his lovely fiance on their engagement. The wedding proposal was dope. You can go check it out on Instagram. I'm pretty sure, Doyle, that Sergio went to a level far, far above anything that I could ever imagine in having an entire mural painted of him proposing to his now fiance. And I could be wrong, it looked like it might have been at the stadium.
Mm-hmm. That's dedication.
It is dedication. It's Hani Mukhtar stuff, if we're being honest. All right, is the Shield race back on? That's our first big question to answer on today's show. What say you? Are we back? No cap, for real, for real? How back are we, Doyle? The crew rizzed up this midweek.
Why are you speaking like this?
And it's giving distracted and flawed for Inter Miami.
I don't understand just what just happened with the way you presented that. But I will say, I guess it's kind of on a little bit for Inter Miami. I am still not picking against them in this race to the Shield. It's gotten a lot harder for them to set the single season points record. They need to win three and draw one And one of those results has to be at Columbus now, and Columbus is a better team than Miami at this point.
So here's where it stands. Miami on 64 points, Columbus with a game in hand, and that's New England in the international break, on 56. So the gap is 8, and that seems insurmountable. Just you look at it and you say, okay, well, we have 4 and 5 games remaining, and oh, by the way, Columbus has to play Club America at home in Campeones Cup midweek. Like, no way this could happen. Well, let me paint a picture for you. Let's say, and this is entirely plausible, that Miami, well, let's say they blow it. They draw at Charlotte, or draw against Charlotte at home. It's plausible. It's unlikely, I would argue, but let's say they do it. At one point, Columbus, who cares what happens against Club America in this equation, but Columbus then at DC get the job done. That's not just plausible. It's likely. So now that's a 2-point swing. Now Columbus beat Miami at home. Okay, now we have narrowed it down even further to 3 points. And now Columbus beats New England at home during the international break. And you're all even with 2 games, basically, to decide the Shield. Those games for Miami would be at Toronto and New England at home. That ain't exactly murderer's row. And for Columbus, those 2 games would be Philly at home and then at Red Bulls on decision day. And I know I've sort of mixed and matched and shuffled the schedules, and it's not entirely linear and the timeline is a little bit off there, but I'm just showing that there is a world in which these things happen, and all of a sudden the crew, who seemed sort of down and out of this thing because Miami had handled business without their 2 biggest stars, now have a possibility to do the double. What percentage chance do we have on this?
It feels like somewhere between 10 and 20%. 20% feels high.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say 0 and 10, probably on the lower end of that scale, because for all the, oh, if this, then that, ultimately it's Miami that have to drop points, Doyle. And I know that they dropped 4 this week from winning positions at Atlanta and at New York City, but Julian Gressel was in the studio with us and it was awesome on Countdown. I hope everybody who enjoys this league got to take a watch of that. He's on 360 as well. It was really good stuff. He just straight up said, yeah, the big guys, the whole team, everybody, we're mad. We're upset about that. And like a mad Lionel Messi, a mad Luis Suarez, looking at a season in which nothing but the best is good enough and seeing that there is a sliver of possibility for someone else and they get to play that team, I would think that's a good formula for not dropping points the rest of the way, but we shall see. Just get your takes real quick on that Miami result against New York City. James Sands rose like a salmon in second half stoppage time. It was a brilliant header. It's his first ever goal in MLS. He did score for Rangers against the mighty Patrick Thistle back in the day, but that's his first MLS goal. How disappointing should that be for Miami?
It's Partick Thistle.
It looks like Patrick. I don't know.
It was a disappointing overall for Miami, even before Sands found that equalizer. Messi was bad. He was as guilty as anyone else on that team of bad touches, sloppy midfield giveaways. The number of times he ran at a defender and expected to beat him 1v1, and whether it was Sands or Keaton Parks or one of the center backs stepping off the back line and just taking the ball off his foot, it was a very un-Messi-like performance. Federico Redondo was really poor as well. Suarez had some moments. I thought our guy Taylor Twellman did a good job of, sort of gently criticizing Suarez's movement in a lot of what Miami were doing, because they didn't need him to drop in and gum up what was already a pretty crowded midfield. They needed him to stay high. And I think it's telling that on the goal, he stays high and occupies the center backs. And that creates space for Messi and Jordi Alba to sort of play underneath. The other part of that is obviously Keaton Parks goes way upfield and misses a challenge. And then it's kind of a semi transition moment for Miami. And, that they didn't get many other of those all game long. But overall, it was just a really poor performance. And honestly, it's 3 straight really poor performances. Yeah, the 2 draws, but also that win against the Union ended up 3-1. There were so many times down the stretch in that game where Miami were inviting the Union to score an equalizer. and Philly just couldn't find it. This team is not playing well right now, and I'm still not picking against them. I still think they're going to get it done, but if they don't, there are plenty of red flags that we could go back afterwards and say, this was real. This was a problem. This wasn't addressed. We should have seen this coming.
That's the second 1-1 draw for New York City against Miami this year. Remember back in, I want to say, might even have been March. It was a 1-1. Alonso Martinez had a goal and so did Suarez. What do you make of New York City? They're in the battle for fourth, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more in terms of the standings. But it feels like they play up to competition often, though haven't yet really got over the line against the best teams, but have challenged the Columbuses of the world. But the reason why they're in this, point of sort of scuffling, trying to find their way right now is because they don't beat the teams that they should beat.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's young team with marginal chemistry in the attack because there are so many new pieces. It's got to be frustrating, though, because Talis Magno was a $10 million signing, and I thought he was pretty good when he played this year, but he's gone now.
I think he's doing pretty well in Brazil, at Corinthians.
He's doing very well at Corinthians, who need the help. Augustin Ojeda, I love this guy when I watch him play. Can't get on the field. Julian Fernandez, I think, really dangerous basically every time he gets out there, can't get on the field. Hannes Wolf, good player, I thought was excellent the first half of the season, but not at that Gabriel Peck, Denny Bouanga, Diego Rossi, Jonathan Rodriguez level.
The production side of it just isn't there.
Yeah, so like they've spent a lot of money on guys who haven't developed. And I think... You know, I think at this point, you kind of like the fans are pointing the finger at Nick Cushing, and I understand why, because he's been the manager for 2.5 years now, is it? Or is it 3.5 years?
I'm not even going to try on that one.
He's been 2.5 years. He's been the manager. That is a long time to still be adrift and kind of having the same issues, especially given the amount of money that has been invested into this club.
11 wins, 11 losses, 8 draws, 0 goal differential. Like just whoop, 500 across the board, basically. The issue for New York City as it pertains to the playoffs and making a leap this season is that they really need the 4 spot. They really need it. It's a young team. They're better at Yankee Stadium, clearly. The home record versus away record, very, very stark. And in the moment of the year in which you earn the 4th spot, basically the final third of the season, they have now not won a game since the 3rd of July.
That's brutal.
That's not going to get it done. All right, how about Columbus? Let's turn our attention, because it was a fun one against Orlando. 7 goals in this match, and Columbus are preparing themselves, of course, for Campeones Cup. But Orlando needed a win against a big team, and they almost got it, and they won the expected goal battle.
Yeah.
Is that a trick because Columbus was up, 3-1, then 4-2? Or
yeah, they were up, 3-1?
3-1, and then the penalty that Columbus didn't like, which that goes into XG, so, you know, the Yaya Boa penalty, the call, you can go to Instant Replay for that breakdown, but I don't think it was, like, unfair. I could also see it not called. But, yeah, it seems like that penalty plus the game state made a tricky XG.
And maybe some dead legs from Columbus. They were up 3-0, right?
Oh, were they?
Cucho scores. In the 71st minute. They're up 3-0. Let go of the rope. And it ends up being 4-3. They needed that Aziel Jackson goal in the 85th minute, that fourth goal, to give them the padding to get all 3 points. Orlando won the XG battle. Something like 85% of their XG came in those last 15 minutes after the Crew took their foot off the gas. And it should be noted, the Crew rotated here. Rossi played the first half. Kucha played the second half. Max Arfson got some rest. Rudy Camacho and Sean Zawadzki didn't play. Zawadzki wasn't even in the match day lineup. I think a few other guys got rested as well. And Wilfred Nancy has said, like, we're playing every 4 days now. And so we are going to rotate. But this one was specifically, I think, rotated to make sure that as many of the core guys as possible will be healthy and rested and ready to go against Club America on Wednesday. I don't think you take nothing from it if you're Orlando, especially because they went down there and were kind of respectable, even without Cesar Araujo. But this was not... The XG in the scoreboard, I don't think were emblematic of what this game actually was. This game showed the gap between those top three teams in the Eastern Conference and the rest of the pack. I still think Orlando are probably the best of that peloton, the best of that group, but something crazy would have to happen for them if they should meet Columbus in the playoffs. Something crazy would have to happen for them to come out of that series.
Let's real quick, before we go into the nitty gritty of Campeones Cup, just give props to the crew as an organization, as a coaching staff, for the AZ Jackson trade. Well, he looked freaking amazing. Like, that is his best MLS game I've ever seen him play. And he had a couple last year with St. Louis where you're like, oh, this is what this guy can do. In the open field, with the ball at his feet, turning, running, driving at back lines, making good decisions, being a good secondary or tertiary runner into dangerous spots. He really looked the part in the two behind the forward in this game. And it's no surprise to me that the crew looked at a guy whose star had dimmed, who seemed to be having some personal issues in St. Louis, and said, he fits. If we can get him in here to our environment, if he works with Wilfred, we can get his confidence back to a level at which his talent will then come out. And talent has never been the issue with AZ. He looked awesome. It was so, so, so fun to watch. Anyway, Campeones Cup. As I said, 6:15, I believe, is the start of the coverage. Full hour of countdown on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV, and then into the final. Got folks on site in Columbus to provide you coverage, plus all the folks in the studio. Should be a fun one. What does this game mean to you, Doyle?
So it's the Campeones Cup, and of all the trophies MLS teams play for, I think this is probably the lowest on the list. It has at times in the past felt a little exhibition-y rather than the sort of heavyweight title fight that it should be. I think this year it's going to be a heavyweight title fight. I think this year, because the crew are who they are and have done what they've done over the past 2 years against Liga MX teams, including it was a 4-1 win against Club America last year in the League's Cup. And because Club America are who they are, the biggest, most successful team in North American soccer history, and one that are by Campeones right now. They won the Apertura and Clausura last year. They're only the fourth Liga MX team ever to do that. So first time Club America have done it. There's an argument among the fans that this might be the best version of Club America ever. They got off to a tough start in this year's Apertura, but they've kind of turned it around a little bit over the past three or four games.
I mean, they are still 10th. They are still 10th, which is completely unacceptable.
Maybe
the winners of those cups were the best. I'm not sure this team would be considered in that conversation.
Back-to-back champions.
I agree. In those moments, they were the best. But right now, the way that it works in Mexico, like that, the page has been turned. Like, Julian Quiñones is not in this team.
And they had that 4-1 to Cruz Azul last month. But like, the light went off, and then it flipped back on after that loss. Like, this is a different team since then. And it's Club America with a trophy on the line. It matters more by definition.
I agree. I think it honestly might matter more because they're struggling right now. And I know in Mexico, the tendency is going to be, and I've seen some headlines here, thank God for Maria for helping us understand what's going down there. That's just like, hey, yeah, I focus on the league. You got to focus on the league. But that's just not how it works for clubs of this magnitude. You don't get to go into a final, even if it's a trophy that might not be, you know, valued in the same way as a Liguilla or a CONCACAF Champions Cup or Copa MX or Leagues Cup or whatever it is. Even if it's not, you don't get to go into a cup final on U.S. soil against a team that has, taken the lunch money from some of the other biggest teams in Mexico and have that happen to you. Like, you want to be the team that's different. You want to be the team that says, yeah, Columbus Crew, that showed Tigres and Monterrey what's up, that probably should have beat Pachuca, but were, you know, expelling things out of the wrong end. You know, hey, you're human. You're still an MLS team. We're still a Liga MX giant. Like, you gotta handle business. You can't, as you're rebuilding your momentum in the league, go to Columbus, get an L hung on you, and come back like everything's okay. It just doesn't work like that. And for the Crew, I think this means a ton. Not in terms of like, oh, if they don't win this, their legacy is this, that, and the other. I think just in personally, Wilfred Nancy and this team, I think it took it very personally what happened to them in Pachuca.
Oh, yeah.
Extremely
we saw
so.
That. We saw that in the League's Cup. And I don't think that that is going to be out of their system just based on
so
one trophy, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just based on the one trophy. The other thing I want to mention here about Club America is they midweek game, a lot of travel. It's going to be tough for them, but they have an easy matchup this coming weekend in Liga MX when they face Pumas. So that's just 3 points for
wow.
them.
Wow.
Right
wow. Maria with the all caps, adios in the chat. No way. Possibly way. Maria, possibly way. Okay, what's your prediction here?
I think the Crew win. I as great as Club America are, and I know, like we just talked about their struggles, I still think this is a top five team in the region. The Crew at home are nearly unbeatable. Nancy has done the right thing in resting his players. And like we just said, they're still pissed. They're still so angry about what happened in Pachuca. And I think they're going to want to take it out on this Club America team.
All right. As I said, I believe the game is at 7:30, but coverage starts at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. You can run it straight into the U.S. Open Cup.
Are you making it? Are you making a prediction?
What? I'll take the Crew as well. I'll take the Crew. The travel for America, the Crew's, I don't know, just the way that they've approached these big Mexican teams when at their best, and in particular, honestly, both home and away. But I think Wilfred and the boys are going to have
so
too much.
Are you going to try to find a bar in Charlotte where you could watch this game with MLS and Liga MX fans? Or are you going to be like cloistered in the hotel room?
No,
locked
no,
in?
No. Like I said, I am cloistered in a windowless basement for like 50 weekends a year watching MLS. I would like to be in a place, one, with windows, preferably, two, with
alcohol,
adult beverages, soda pops, as I can't remember which coach said that recently, and also with my people, man. And if America fans are there, that's amazing. I don't know what the bar scene is like in Charlotte. I don't know. I'll have to talk to Lloyd Sam maybe about this. He probably knows. Eric Krakauer has a feel for that, perhaps, though he has a family, so I know how that goes. But Lloyd is just living the single man life. He's just chilling. So I'll probably talk to Lloyd about that. And if you have ideas, my DMs are always open. All right, it's our match of the match day, and I have this little feeling, and I just can't remember, that maybe Soccer-Wise has a match of the match day. So if they do, Dave, I really apologize. But not to you, Tom. I don't apologize to you. A match of the match day was a 3-3 draw between the Portland Timbers and Real Salt Lake. The Timbers were hot garbage in the first half, Doyle. A 2-0 lead for RSL. Looked like they were back. They were rolling. They didn't even start Chicho. Diego Gonzalez was on the bench as well. And then things turned around thanks to our MVP candidate slash maybe becoming favorite, Evander. And then some vintage MLS After Dark chaos at the end. Phil Neville postgame after RSL went up 3-2 on a Gonzalez goal. And then Jonathan Rodriguez tied the game late on from an insane cross from Miguel Araujo, said, "I think this team is going to kill me. And if they do, I think I'll go happy," which is an incredible quote from Phil after an incredible game. What was the vibe level on this one? What was the chaos level for you?
It felt like RSL of 3 years ago. And that was a difference of RSL the first half of the year and RSL of the last like 8 weeks or so. They don't exert the kind of control over games that they were from February through like the end of June. Pablo Mascheroni talked about this a little bit. He was a little more rosy about it in the post game than I am. They're just not as clean and precise and rhythmic with
the
ball.
Yes, I agree with that.
And I think that's allowing games to get scattered. And when games get scattered against a team like Portland, players like Evander and Jonathan Rodriguez and Santi Moreno and Felipe, like you're going to give up goals. And that was the story of the second half in this one. Even when they brought Diogo Gonçalves on and I thought he was good for the first time, it was still sort of like you're snatching at moments rather than actually controlling the flow of the game. And it kind of makes sense because we think of, you know, RSL have made the playoffs 3 straight years. So it feels like, and Pablo's been there for all of that. And
I want to say for RSL, it's like, it's something crazy. It's like 13 of the last 15 or it's a true sustained playoff standard.
Yes. And because of that, it feels like, oh, they're just building on what they had. And it's like, no, this is a different team. This is a very different team. The D-mid was a right back and the number 10 was brought in 3 weeks ago and your second best player is now in France and your best player is, he just got his first goal contribution in 3 months and your, you know, star left wing playmaker, this is his first year as a starter and your left back was brought in March. Yep. It's a lot. Your goalkeeper's 18. And so it makes sense that they're sort of slipping a little bit at this point in time. And I thought Pablo Mascherini kind of talked around that in a really smart way in the postgame. Like it made me feel like he has a handle on what's going on and maybe it doesn't get fixed in time for them to really threaten this postseason. But this is why 13 of the last 15 or whatever it is, they have been in the playoffs. And it's just like, it gives me confidence that there's a lot of thought being put into the structure of this team and how to make it sustainably good and occasionally, hopefully, championship winning level great. For Portland,
Can I just go on RSL real quick? Because I completely agree with everything that you're saying here. Pablo is having to rejigger, refigure out, remotivate, refocus this team and remake them, because it's not the same team or the same vibes or the same, you know, sort of mastery of the game model or just individual brilliance that they had before League's Cup. Like before League's Cup, we always talked about the game model and that was all true. But what was even more true was that Andres Gomez was having a generational winger season. Like not just for Andres Gomez, for any player. Like if you looked at his production over that time and compared it worldwide to wingers, I haven't done the research, but I'm gonna tell you right now, 20 plus goal contributions in that number of games, he's gonna be in the absolute top echelon. And his chemistry with Chicho Arango was like those. You know, you meet somebody, it's a friend, maybe it's your partner, a coach, whatever. That you meet like 4 or 5 people in your lifetime where you're like, this just clicks, dude. Like everything about this works. It makes me feel good. The results are amazing. Like everybody else can just sort of float off those vibes. That's what that was between Chicho and Gomez. They went off the page a lot. It wasn't always, oh, well, that was a result of the game model. It was, hey, those guys are on a different level.
They saw a gap. They saw something to exploit. And as one, it clicked and they yes, exploited it.
Absolutely.
And
it's
have
contagious.
That right now.
It's contagious.
I want to say, we saw a little of that on the Gonçalves goal. I think that was something that didn't necessarily come out of the game model. That was Arango and Gonçalves sort of being on the right page. And saying, oh, here's an opportunity. Let's go. And I think that has to be heartening if you're an RSL fan.
Chicho's just got to learn to trust all these new guys around him. And he's also got to refine himself because it's very clear that he is not anywhere close to the level of sharpness that he was at. And look, that can come back. And with forwards, it can come back quickly. It sometimes is one of those things where it just feels like, you know, the dominoes start falling, goal here, a goal there, a break here or there. And that was one reason I was disappointed for him in the Houston game when they were terrible, that deflection got ruled an own goal. Sometimes those gifts can just like get in your mind as a forward and you'd be like, well, I'm not snake bit after all. Like I'm not, it's not that I'm bad right now. It's just that I can't buy a goal. He needed to buy a goal. I thought the Dar Marjouk goal was a good sign. Mm-hmm. To have that production out there, he's a different sort of player than Andres Gomez, who was just a like, hey, get me in space, get me with a little runway, and I'm going to cook people. Dom's a little bit more tactical, it feels like, but he's still really technical, but he's not going to be quite the 1v1 threat I think that Gomez was. The other thing I'll say about this team is that Pablo was very clear when I talked to him last week that what they need to rediscover more than the game model, more than anything else, is to one, stop thinking so much and get into a flow state. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a team that needs to be doing things, and when they start standing or the game slows down or they're forced to really, like, they just need to be going. Like, go, do it. Like, don't wait around. Press as a group. Recover as a group. When you see an opening, go. Don't try to slow the game down too much. Now, look, if you're not at your best, that's not going to work as well against the Portland Timbers. And then two, like, he was like, hey, we got to find our dog again, because we had a ton of talent. We still do. But like against the Portland Timbers, you are not going to out-talent them in the attacking side of the ball. So typical Pablo, he's like, yo, let's get back to being a dog, because their press is what predicated so much in the early going. Like, they just put teams under pressure. And once they got the ball, they came at you quickly. They played in the right areas of the field and they protected themselves from defensive transition. So look, they're figuring it out. They're figuring it out, and I trust Pablo to get it done. How about the Portland Timbers? Can they really be a threat in the West with this defensive frailty? Because the first half was shocking.
The team that I was comparing the Timbers to was the early Schmetzer, Ladero era Sounders, where it was tough to put your finger on what made them so good. Like, to me, Portland doesn't have a defining characteristic in how they play. It's just a basic 4-2-3-1 with the number 10, both wingers and center forward, all being well above average to super freaking elite.
Let me suggest the one thing that is. Here's the you always see this. This is a universal truth of the Timbers. Evander has the freedom to do and go what he wants, and everything else is predicated off of that.
And that is the comparison to early Ladero era Sounders, because that was for 4 or 5 years. We were like, Ladero is the system. And then 2021 happens and they're still good without him. And like, everybody kind of realized, oh, Schmetzer is more than just a babysitter. He's a really good coach. And that is what I sort of gravitate to when I think about Portland. And because of that, I don't think I've written as much about Portland this year, because it's hard to say, yeah, they're just like a default team with really good pieces, but I don't know how else to describe it. The difference is those Sounders teams had Chad Marshall, Roman Torres, Kim Ki-hee as their center backs. They had, to use a word that I think you used in the pre-show, that very professional fullbacks.
Yes.
Guys who just did the job. They would get forward when they needed to get forward, but for the most part, they were there to support the attackers and not take too many risks. And therein is the big difference between those Sounders teams and this Portland team, is that, first of all, we're not all in on the center backs. I'm still not sure.
The Timbers are not in on the center backs. I mean, they've said publicly, like, we need to make changes in that area of the field, and understandably so.
Yeah,
fullback, I would add to that as well. Oh, by the way, they didn't have this Timbers team doesn't have a Steph Fry level goal. I mean, look, Max Crepeau is a very good goalkeeper.
He is.
Steph Fry at that time with the players in front of him that he had. I mean, it's not just a goalkeeper. It's like, hey, what's the combination around you? And Crepeau doesn't have the same help by any means that Steph had.
But I think out of all of it, the biggest thing, even bigger than the talent differential in center back, is just the functioning of the fullbacks. The difference between the Timbers, who still are letting both Bravo and Mosquera, when they're on the field together, which is often, they let them both go. They let them both push up, and they get exposed in ways that are similar to what we were talking about with the Galaxy. And I think that the Timbers can outscore a couple of teams in the Western Conference playoffs. I think they could make the Western Conference final. If they were to come up against LAFC or even Houston, I would have trouble envisioning a way for them to make MLS Cup. Just because I think you need to exert some level of control over the game, both with and without the ball. And the risks that Portland take don't seem calculated towards that.
I think the Timbers know full well that it's going to be a real slog for them if they don't get home field advantage. They're just inherently a much different team. The numbers bear this out. The eye test bears it out. I know this was a 3-3 draw on the road, but they, away from Providence Park, if you got to do it twice in the first round, if you got to go do it in the ensuing rounds repeatedly, that's not a recipe for success for the Portland Timbers to make a run all the way to Cup. But hey, maybe that's not where this project is at right now. But long term, if the project wants to stay the project, Evander's got to stay. I straight up asked Evander on the pregame show this week, and we had him as an interview, and he is a great interview, as anybody who listens to this show knows. You know, we talked to him about it earlier this year when he was like, hey, the reason why I wanted to go to Brazil was this. I want to play with the national team. I said, what's it going to take to keep you in Portland long term? And he said, ask the GM and the owner. He did also mention, I have a long term contract, but it is beyond obvious that if the Portland Timbers want to keep Evander long term happy and stave off these repeated bids that they keep getting, which haven't been nearly enough to make them even consider, they'll either have to give him a new contract, get him more in line with his peers in the league, or they're going to have to put it out on the streets that they need 20 mil.
Like, who are his peers in the league at this point?
Oh, peers in the league. I think like Ricky's a good peer. Like younger age profile, production, championship, ambition. Probably Lucho is going to be a good peer for me, though at a different age profile, but sort of the same in sense of like, hey, this is the centerpiece around which you build. I think Hani would be a decent one. Like maybe not the way Hani's playing right now, but when Hani got a new contract and the level that he was at prior to that, Hani would be a good comparison for me. What are those guys at? Those guys are in like 4.5 mil.
Ricky is a little bit lower. He's at about 2.5, which is the same.
But he
number.
Signed a new deal. That's
true, and we haven't seen the number on.
Yeah, I gotta imagine he's up in the four zone.
Those guys are all between like 4.2 and 5.2.
What's Cucho at? Cucho's probably in the same boat as Evander, honestly.
I think he's a little bit more old. Cucho is at 2.9. It's actually Diego Rossi who's at 3.4 on that team.
Yeah, it feels like Cucho is another guy whose contract is up in 2025, though there's an option for 26. He's another guy that you would put in the Evander boat of like, hey, we're hitting a moment here where other teams are going to say this is the right number of years left for us to start making offers, and the performance and the age profile is very, very interesting. Anyway, let's hit the bubble. Bubble Boys, the life around the playoff line. We're starting with the Western Conference, Doyle, because it always feels like we give short shrift to the West. And, you know, that's our inherent biases, us being over here on the East Coast. Austin is dead. They're dead. We've been saying this. Their schedule is just, it's such that they were going to have to basically play at a level that they're not capable of to even make a run for this thing. And right now on 35 points, they are 7 points out with 4 games remaining. They're dead. So dead that a local reporter is asking Josh Wolf if he'll resign out of shame, basically, if they miss the playoffs. Poof, to be a fly on that wall. Minnesota, meanwhile, beat hapless, vibeless Kansas City. Kelvin Yeboah got an open play goal, so good for him. Minnesota needed that win. The game got delayed by rain and, I believe, lightning in Kansas City. And in the meantime, Dallas had whomped, tired and rotated LAFC 3-1. I think the big interesting conversation here is, should Peter Boutsen get the Dallas job, regardless of whether Dallas make the playoffs?
Yes. I think we've seen enough from him in terms of how his team is going to play, including this game against LAFC, who were, as you said, tired and rotated and absolutely battered by FC Dallas, who for the first time all year were able to start Petar Musa, who then came off injured after half an hour, but Peter Musa
scored the first scored. Dallas player to score 15 in his first season.
Jesus Ferreira and Alan Velasco together, and it was awesome. And their structure is similar to what they were doing under Nico Estevez, but the principle is to play more downhill with Nico Estevez. The often they would break lines, and then instead of pressing the advantage they had just created, they would snap back into their preset scripted patterns of play.
They were recovering territory and controlling parts of the field more so than trying to create the threat.
With Peter Luxon, they are trying to create the threat, and they're really good at it against some pretty good teams. Like we're starting to build a pretty good compendium of performances for this team. Doing it now with the DPs back.
Compendium. That, well done.
Yeah. After my phonemic paraphasia earlier in this episode.
Woo! This man's on fire.
The other thing, and this is another good point that you made in the pre-show, he kind of brings it back to what FC Dallas was, given his experience there as both as a player and in the academy. And we haven't really seen him push young players in yet because there hasn't been a lot of good young players coming from Dallas's academy the past couple of years.
Is this the time? Like, he's fighting for his job and he's fighting to get a team into the playoffs that has the talent to get there. Oh, by the way, DP's returning. The way I would describe that, Doyle, is that you hire Peter Luxain because he brings the soul of FC Dallas back. I think Luchi Gonzalez and Papi Oscar Pareja, they understood what the soul of the club was supposed to be through their own experiences. Oscar, you know, obviously as a player, but then also in the academy, and Luchi in the academy as well. They understood that this market, given the talent around it, given the way the club is built, needs to value, advance, integrate talented young players into the first team, give them opportunities, and you'll get rewarded for it. What the change was under Nico, which I think was going a little bit away from that soul, not through the fault of Nico Estevez. I'm not blaming him in any way. I'm just saying in terms of starting to spend a little bit more money to augment that, like this is a return. Now you have the money spent and you have the guy that's been in the organization, that's been on the ground, that understands, you know, the depth of talent, the environment, how to bring that talent through and develop it. And you can combine the two. And oh, by the way, he's playing soccer that you want to watch and getting results in the process. Like it to me, it brings them back to who they're supposed to be, who they want to be, who FC Dallas and like the mind's eye of the Hunts and everyone else, who what they think this project can be its very best. I would just challenge them not to slow down. You know, that's kind of my whole point when we talk on MLS Countdown about the new stadium. And I'm like, hey, I'm juiced for them. This looks freaking amazing. That is a jewel. Like the commitment of Frisco to this team, to this club, and you know the way the Hunts have built that entire complex out is amazing. But what I want more than the building of that stadium is for a winner to be built, for a cup winner to be built, for FC Dallas to do what the Union have tried to prove as well, which is that we can win with our guys. We can win with people that grew up around our stadium, that have been in our club for 10 or 15 years, who have their pinnacle moment with a team with a crest on their chest that they wore before they were ever paid to do it. So like, man, Luxain seems to have the vibes. He seems to have the tactical side. He seems to have the trust of the organization. He seems to have the inherent understanding of what that they want to be. Now the question is, can they get to the pinnacle? But when I watch this team play, it's so refreshing. And I just want to throw this at you and get your thought on it. It feels to me like, one, they have the right personnel now because Jesus Ferreira absolutely freaking balled out in this game. He was just dropping dimes the entire time. Velasco showed flashes of why you pay $7-8 million for him. And then, you know, the structure is really good. You have Juan overlapping Ferreira, and now you have depth and width from both fullbacks. Oh, and oh, by the way, there's always one player checking back in to the half space while three or four players are stretching the line in front of them. And then you're rinsing and repeating and playing through Ferreira. And it's just so hard to defend. And it has little similarities to how the Crew play. Just in the way that they unbalance you.
It has a lot of similarities to how the Crew play.
It's fun. It's so fun. It's so fun. They probably won't make the playoffs though, right?
I would be surprised because Yeboah has been awesome for Minnesota United. They look better structurally than they had, though they weren't great against Sporting Kansas City, but now they have the ability, just because of the personnel that they added, to survive and smash and grab. Bongi's hot right now. Yeboah's hot right now. Two goal scorers. Robin Lud is still excellent. I think if they were going to fail, it would have happened already. And now, 5 points? With 4 games remaining, it feels like a lot.
Yeah, the one thing I'll also say about Dallas here with Luxain is you do have to wonder what will happen with Jesus and Velasco in the offseason. So that's why I say this is great. Now, you'd have to keep that commitment up. Like, it just doesn't stop in this league anymore with the level of spin, with the talent around the league. Like, you can't do it once and say, oh, hey, this worked. It has to be repeatable for FC Dallas. But good signs right now, even if they can't win on the road, which is probably why they won't make the playoffs. U.S. Open Cup final preview here. We didn't talk much about Kansas City or LAFC. That's because they have a bigger game coming up, 10:30 p.m. Eastern. It's for free on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. I'm just going to ask you, what's at stake for these teams? What's at stake for LAFC?
They've been in five finals, right? This will be their sixth. The only one they won, they had to go to penalties at home against a team that they were man for man far more talented than. Over the past 2 years. Over their past four finals, they got blown out by Club León. They lost to Club León again on penalties in Campeones Cup, and they were played off the field by the Crew twice. It feels like a lot's at stake here because you're not going to get an easier final in your entire life than at home against a Sporting Kansas City team that's already been eliminated. I do think Sporting are better than their current position in the standings, but not by a ton. And yeah, LAFC are struggling right now, but LAFC are still man for man far superior to than Sporting KC. They're playing at home. They rotated their squad, so they should be mostly rested. And they have a lot to prove given the way they got handled by Columbus in the League's Cup final a month ago. There's a ton at stake for LAFC because if they don't win a trophy, if they don't win the U.S. Open Cup with this scenario, then you start questioning whether they're ever going to be able to win another one unless they go out and they make a Bale level signing every single year.
Yeah, it's a scar tissue issue, right? Like, they're just so, it's been building and building and building, and most of the situations in which it's built, you're like, okay, well, that was a good team that beat them. They're tired. Where they're coming off international break, where another international break is coming up, where they've lost a rivalry game. They need momentum. They need that little spark within a season that kind of gets you back on track. This could be it. For Kansas City, there is no spark to get them back on track. There's just, it's not a consolation prize. It'd be a wonderful prize, but it's to salvage something from 2024, and it's to make history. They would tie, Doyle, and this is what makes the Open Cup so amazing and why I love this tournament. They would tie Maccabi Los Angeles and Bethlehem Steel for the most Open Cup wins ever if Kansas City wins this game and makes it five in their history. That is so awesome, and it's everything that makes this competition special. I mean, the mashup of historical eras, the joining of these legendary teams from a different time and a different, you know, sort of place within the sport with a modern era team. You know, it's everything you want it to be, and it's the first final for Kansas City since 2017 Open Cup final. And
I remember we were at.
Yeah, I remember standing on that field with you, and I think we probably were all thinking this as Latif Blessing did a jig on the field, and Kansas City painted the wall and celebrated. I remember sort of thinking, man, Kansas City has four trophies in their last six seasons. Peter Vermes has built this club into, you know, maybe not a dynasty, but a powerhouse, and a powerhouse that has even more potential that it feels like that they're going to realize. And they've quote unquote won the West in the regular season, but not a shield twice in the ensuing years. But then they've had big fall offs. They haven't made a conference final in the playoffs during this period from 2017 until now. And all of this kind of hope and belief and, you know, promise that I remember feeling. I also remember going back to the Airbnb with all the guys and having a Brown Liquor special. That was a fun time. It feels like it's sort of frittered away. It's like been dust in the wind in a way. And that momentum feels gone and the direction of the club feels gone. And God, they need this.
All that stuff that we were talking about with RSL being so consistent and being a playoff team every year and occasionally a high level one, that's what Sporting Kansas City were from like 2010 to 2018. And they have been the opposite of that since then. And Sporting Kansas City did it over that time period at a higher level than RSL have done it over the past decade.
Yeah, I mean, first in the West in 18, first in the West in 2020, even though that was a weird one. Third in the West in 2021, And then it's been 12th, 8th, bottom of the West somewhere this year. Not bottom, because San Jose, as we'll talk about. But
I mean, if you go back to 19,
Non-competitive.
They were bad in 2019 as well.
That's
so it's been more down than up over the past half decade. We've talked about it a lot, that they're in the midst of this three-window rebuild. I think that that has already started. We've already seen it started in a weird way, I should say, where it's not about the players they brought in this summer. It's about trying the players that they already have in new spots. Jake Davis in central midfield being an example. They've gone to more of a 4-2-3-1 recently. I think they should absolutely start William Agata and Stephen Afrifa in this game. And I know that there's going to be frustration because Agata took a penalty and rigged the woodwork, and that changed. I mean, that would have been a 1-1 this weekend if Agata buries his penalty.
Look, Johnny Russell should tell Agata, I'm taking this. Also, there should be a designated penalty kick taker. I'm not putting that on Agata, man. That should be...
I mean,
you shouldn't miss it, but also that should be decided.
Maybe there is, but also he's the leading goal scorer for this team. He's their most dangerous player.
He is.
If the coach designates someone else to take the penalties, and I'm the leading goal scorer, I probably run up there and take the ball and say, no, I'm taking this.
That's why now, it's Johnny. Nobody taking that ball from Johnny.
Granted, now that he's 0-2, I don't think he has that license to take the ball anymore. I think that'll be the last penalty Mr. Agata takes for a while, but he's still a really good player.
Suspended anyway, license.
I will have a postmortem on Sporting KC coming, a written postmortem coming this week. Same for San Jose. We'll talk more about those teams on Thursday.
We will. I'll just give you one quote from San Jose and then go to the East. From Jeremy Obobese, quote, everything is a disaster, frankly. And that sums it up. Eastern Conference bubble. Toronto rotated and they're focusing on the Canadian Championship on Wednesday night in Vancouver. Well, Philly are really good. They whomped, just beat down DC on Sunday. That was a big time win for them. A must win. They've got Atlanta at home next. Then it gets hard. Meanwhile, Montreal had a comeback draw at New England. New England just keep blowing it at home. Nashville had a crazy draw at Cincinnati with some refereeing question marks that really shouldn't be question marks. And I explained those to you in instant replay. And Atlanta had an absolute disaster class at Red Bulls Doyle. Edwin Mascara with what should have been a game winner. Didn't happen. A last Manuel experience jumped up. Let's just start with Philly. What did they show you? What are they showing you right now? They are the best team in this group. It's just a question mark as to whether their early season stumbles, self-inflicted and otherwise, are going to hold them back.
Yeah, especially with Andre Blake back. This team is someone that I don't think anybody would want to face in the playoffs. That said, I don't think they're going to be... Like, if you're in 7th, 8th, or 9th, then... And assuming you come out of that 8-9 game, you're facing Miami or Columbus in the first round, most likely. And I don't think any of these teams, including Philly, have a particularly realistic chance of winning that series. So if you're the Union, just try to, you know, win as many games as you can, get into eighth place, get a, you know, home game in the play-in round, and you know, hopefully give your fans something to cheer about in that one. And right now it should be noted they are 8th on points per game. They are ahead of Toronto on points per game because the Union have played 30 games. Toronto have played 31. But then it's just, you got to win 2 out of 3 against Messi and Suarez and company. And I just don't think the Union are, I don't think any of these teams are capable of that.
I want to just read off some goal differentials here. In 8th place, Toronto FC, minus 17 goal differential. In 9th, Philadelphia, plus 10. Pretty, that's good. That's a solid team. That's better than everybody but Columbus, Cincinnati, and Miami in the East. In 10th, Montreal, who are just 2 points out, minus 20 goal differential. Atlanta, 3 points off the pace, minus 4. Hey, that's respectable. Nashville, 3 points off the pace, minus 15. DC, 3 points off the pace, minus 17. This is not exactly murderer's row here. I do want to just give one person his flowers before we move on. That's Quinn Sullivan. The Union absolutely abused the left side of that DC back line, and Quinn Sullivan if nothing else, Doyle, not always completely technically clean, though often very effective, he is just so relentlessly direct. If you give him an inch, he's like, I think I can get a mile. And he got like 15 miles against that DC side.
3 goals, 10 assists, and...
he's up to 10 assists?
Mm-hmm, and Woo. Most of them are like the ones that we saw last night where he wins the ball high, or he gets on the ball high against a defense that's already disorganized, and he just relentlessly drives the ball low and hard across the six. His underlying numbers in terms of chance creation are very good because of that. And it's worth remembering, he doesn't even play really an attacking position. He spends most of his time as a shuttler in a 4-4-2 diamond, which is a hybrid position. But his engine, his athleticism, his overall soccer savvy, just a really good winning player. And he fits with any type of sort of running mate because he's a force magnifier with his movement. He covers up mistakes with his energy and his defensive IQ. This is what they were hoping for, right? This is like, oh God, who's going to be our next Ali Bedoya? And like, they got one, and he came out of their academy, and that is why the Union are able to ball on a budget and make the playoffs year after year after year. And they're going to make them again this year.
And this is the sort of player, you know, let's toss Nason Harial, for instance, from this lineup into the same sort of, I mean, even like a Andrew Rick who stood in for Andre Blake. These are the sort of players, to go back to that Dallas conversation, that we're saying, hey, Dallas, if you can add that player and you can do the Petar Musa, Jesus Ferreira, and Alan Velasco game, that's where you can find that different level. That's where you can go win an MLS Cup. All right, how about this? Who do you believe in more? I believe in the Union. I just don't know if they have the schedule to get it done. Who do you believe in more? Toronto, Montreal, Nashville, Atlanta, or DC?
I believe in Nashville the most out of that group. I think they have the highest level players in terms of Hani Mukhtar and Walker Zimmerman. And I think they've started to figure out their identity a bit under BJ Callahan. They're still not a high percentage possession team, but they're not hitting as many long balls. They're not hitting anywhere near as many crosses, thank God, as they did under Gary Smith. They're actually playing with the ball on the ground through central midfield. Jonathan Perez has been, a little bit spicy in attack, which you love to see. They got him on loan from the Galaxy, but they have a purchase option on that. And if he keeps playing like this, they will exercise it. So they found some answers where for most of the summer, all they had were questions and despair. I like the way they're playing.
I think Cincinnati should have won that game. Cincinnati's got to be kicking themselves a little bit on that one. But
the fact that they went toe to toe with Cincinnati, and this is a as close to a full strength Cincinnati as you basically get these days,
which is at like 70%. But you know, that's neither here nor there.
And like the remainder of the schedule for Nashville at New England, and New England have fallen completely apart.
We'll
DC at home, at NYCFC, at Chicago. There's a lot of points available on that schedule.
Can I interest you in San Jose at home, at Atlanta, at Charlotte, New York City at home? Now, that doesn't seem quite as easy. I think Nashville's is easier, but Montreal's got a pretty cush one the rest of the way, thanks to the schedule makers as well. I don't believe in, honestly, any of these teams. I just think no matter who it is going to...
Yeah, the belief is relative to the other teams in this group.
Correct. They're all going to be fodder in the first round, whoever gets through. Philly is the only team that I would say, hey, you got a chance in a 3-game series. Absolutely. We shall see. Let's talk about a team that seems to be completely out of chances, and that is the New England Revolution. They're in last in the Eastern Conference. They put their club culture on display this weekend against Charlotte in a 4-0 loss, and what was on display was a tire fire. Carlos Hill and Xavier Arriaga had a public shoving match on the field on the way to the locker room at halftime, which Caleb Porter called embarrassing. He said Hill was trying to hold Arriaga accountable, and Arriaga did not take it well. He came right back at the best player in club history, arguably, for the Rebs. Dylan Barrero, who's recently been benched reportedly for attitude issues, got sent off after a terrible tackle that was a yellow card for obvious dissent. Not like one of those situations where you're like, man, that, the referee just kind of went a little too far on this one. It's like, no, Dylan Barrero went too far and deserved his marching order. And they lost 4-0 against a team that hasn't been able to score this year, that had won one game in eight in Charlotte. And since September 1st, when the Revs were on 26 points, they were last in the East, but they were 5 points off the playoff line with two games in hand and nine games remaining. Since September 1st, they lost 2-0 at RSL. Then they went home against St. Louis. They were up 1-0. They blew that 1-0 lead in the 90+5 to drop 2 points. They lost 3-0 at Orlando. Montreal at home, they were up 2-0 inside 35 minutes. They blew that game for a draw, dropped two more points. Then they went to Charlotte and lost 4-0. Now they're 8 points back with one game in hand on most. Negative vibes. Negative vibes. This season has been a shambles from start and now to finish.
How surprised are you?
Not really surprised at all.
Within the first three or four games, Caleb Porter kind of threw his team under the bus. We saw the refs struggling, and we heard him in the post game. The players aren't good enough. We need different players. When a coach comes in and immediately says that, I just don't know if you can expect to have a fully functional season. So I'm not surprised either. Even though I think there's a lot of talent on this team, even though, you know, Curt Anolfo and that front office said, okay, you want different players? We'll go out and get you a ton of different players in the summer transfer window. And they did. Traded a lot of guys who had been around for a long time, DeJuan Jones, Henry Kessler. Brought in a new goalkeeper. They brought in new players. And the Revs, if anything, are playing worse. I'm not surprised.
Who's going to get fourth in the East? We got Red Bulls, Orlando, Charlotte, and New York City. Credit to Charlotte. They've been searching for it. They finally found it thanks to this New England team. Pat Agyeman has been there all along. I hope Dean Smith has found him as their starter, because Agyeman came off the bench for Swiderski and just completely balled out, like dominated in the final third and was direct and positive. And I mean, like a dribble merchant in addition to being a great goal scorer in the 18, like all the things that they need. To be fair, he hasn't been consistently those things all year, but they've all been sort of bubbling under the surface. What do you think? Red Bulls contrived to draw. Orlando almost got it done against a good team. Charlotte whooped a terrible team, and New York City got a draw that felt like a win just because of the opponent.
I think it goes Charlotte fourth, Orlando fifth, Red Bulls sixth, and NYCFC seventh.
Is that because of Charlotte's schedule? It is at Miami, yes. But yes. Then it's Chicago and Montreal at home, and then at DC.
Yes. Mm. That is why. That schedule, and just what Agyeman showed, it's not that he changed the game. It's that he was the best player on the field for a half an hour. And look, there's a good amount of data now that shows that he actually is this guy. He's got 12 goals and 5 assists in about 2,200 minutes.
It's 8-5 in about 17. It's 8-5 in 1,700 this year.
About across all competitions with the first team, like he is producing at an above average starting number 9 level. And he's done all of that while learning the professional game. He's still just 23 years old, and they haven't had a playmaker until Pep Biel got onto the field 15 minutes ago.
And guess what? Pep Biel's goal, the playmaker on that play, was Pat Agyeman.
Yeah.
Dribbling the entire Revs team and choosing the right pass in the big moment. That was the key to me.
I just hope that Charlotte don't make the same mistake the Red Bulls made with Brian White when they didn't value him properly because they got him for free in the draft. And teams have a tendency to look past those guys and recruit over those guys. And they traded Brian White for $400,000. Worth a gam. I'm telling you, Charlotte do not need to go out and buy a DP number 9 this offseason. Spend that DP slot elsewhere to make the midfield even better. Keep BL or get, you know, a high level number 10. as another DP. If you do that, you're creating an ecosystem in which Pat Ajimon can give you 15 goals and 8 assists. And as a 23-year-old that you got for free, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, man.
I'm hopeful that that's where they'll go. And it's what I think we both have been arguing all year here with them. I remember going on Wrap Up and Brad and Sash both, we had the little whiteboards and it's like, what does Charlotte need? And they're both like a number 9. I'm like, no, nope. Guys, like they don't create chances. Like, again, you can't have the cart before the horse, so to speak. So I'm hopeful because Toklamati was elevated to the first team. He's a U22 forward. If you've got him and he has a little time and you have Pat, you got to get the wingers going. They've been bereft for the better part of 2 or 3 months. Like, and you need somebody to orchestrate a little bit. And it's not going to be a traditional, you know, passenger on defense 10 for Dean Smith. I hope they can go find that guy, whether it's Pat BL or otherwise, TBD. All right, before we get out of here, enjoy your championship week, everybody. But voting is now open for the 22 under 22. You know how we feel about that. And Doyle, you have put together your preliminary list. It's not locked in stone. So I'm going to ask you some questions about your ballot as it stands right now. I will start with the obvious one. Who is number one?
Diego Gomez.
Seems like an obvious one to me.
It's easy. Yeah, this one was. And just for the record, Andres Gomez would have been too old for this. If he had been around and if he had been 3 months younger, he would have been number one.
I want to say about Miami, which we didn't mention, Gomez has been injured. Matias Rojas has been injured. David Martinez also injured. And Busquets did not play in New York City. So if you're thinking about the Shield race and guys that could impact it, all those guys will be right in that spot. Who is the name that people would say, wait, who? That you had on this list?
I had Nathan Saliba number 5.
Hell yeah.
He is a real freaking baller. Montreal playing better recently, and we probably didn't talk about it enough in the previous segment. A lot of that has come from more of the game being at Saliba's feet in central midfield now. He's an elite talent. The other one, Patrickson Delgado, playing as a central midfielder for both Nico Estevez and Peter Luzon. I think he's more of a box-to-box guy. We've seen him play some as an attacker as well. He scored a goal this past weekend.
But he arrives well as that box-to-box guy.
He arrives really well, Cole Bassett-like. I had him number 9, Patrickson Delgado. A year from now, that could feel incredibly low. Those two guys, the rest of them is pretty paint-by-numbers from me.
Okay. How about who was a guy who had trouble placing that you knew you wanted in the list, but you had trouble placing?
Federico Redondo. I ended up having him 6th, and I loved this guy coming into the league. And obviously, his father is one of my favorite players of all time. And he hasn't been as good as I had hoped. And look, he was terrible this weekend, and that game was fresh in my head when I was making my list. That said, he's a starter for a team that's going to end up on 73, 74 points. He was sold for $10 million for a reason, right? He's already commanded that type of, like, if Jack McGlynn turned into what Federico Redondo is right now, I don't think we would be super disappointed.
If we could give Jack McGlynn Redondo's physical gifts.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Jack McGlynn, that would be a new number one on the board.
Good freaking Lord. How about this one? Here's a funny one for you. Who's the youngest player on your list?
I think it's Christian No, it's actually Julian Hall from the Red Bulls. Christian McFarlane from NYCFC, I have him 11th because he's half won a starting job and he's most likely headed off to Manchester City in the winter. Julian Hall has been really good for the Red Bulls in very limited minutes. And I think he's going to get more minutes down the stretch here. And if you look at what he's done at the youth level as well, and just the scouting reports that we get from Brad is really high on him. And Brad knows a thing or two about scoring goals.
Julian Hall became the third youngest player in MLS history to get his first career assist this weekend, 16 years, 181 days. Who were the two younger?
Obviously Freddie.
Yep.
Gianluca Busio.
That is correct. That is correct. All right. Last one.
Who I believe scored his first Serie A goal.
Did you watch the goal?
I did. Absolute banger. Galassa.
A lot of Schross energy on that one. Not even energy, just Cross energy. And I'll ask you this. Who's 22nd? Who made it at the very end?
So, Esmir Bayraktarevich. And when I wrote my 22-under-22 preview article this summer, I actually had him off the list because I'm always concerned about undersized wingers who aren't particularly athletic and don't create a lot of penetration. And since then, he's been more, it's like the one silver lining, he's been more of a north-south player for the Revs. He's been getting into the box more. When he gets into the final third, he's more decisive. He plays with more decisiveness. He hits it, like he sees a space, he takes the space, he puts opposing back lines under pressure and forces them to make those decisions. So he's more than just a guy with tricky skills now. It's been a nice development for him. And this is another one where a year from now, it might feel like he was criminally underrated.
All right, just remember, these are the people, Doyle, myself, all the other voters who left John Duran off 22-under-22 when he was with the Chicago
Fire. Blame that on Ezra. He couldn't get on the field for Ezra.
Just had to say it. All right, that's it for us. Hope you enjoyed Match Day 34. Certainly, you will enjoy Championship Wednesday coming up on, you guessed it, Wednesday. Coverage starting at 6:15 p.m. Eastern Time on MLS Season Pass. Ahead of Campeones Cup, then we'll go to Canadian Championship with a CCC spot on the line and finish off with the U.S. Open Cup Final in downtown Los Angeles. You can watch that one for free on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. This show will be back on Thursday to wrap it all up and look ahead to Match Day 35. In the meantime, have a wonderful week, everybody. Adios.